Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. You are listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Once a week, we take on some of the more serious issues that I believe are not being honestly, even comprehensively addressed, and yet issues that impact all of us one way or the other. Our topic today is debt relief and debt forgiveness. The panel who will be joining us include Professor Andrew Ross. Professor Ross is Professor of Social and Cultural Analysis, New York University, where his research focuses on labor and urban studies and social and political theory, ecology and cultural studies. He's a leading organizer of Strike Debt, a national organization that emerged from the Occupy movement in order to build resistance to all forms of debt imposed upon citizens by banks. And earlier help was found with the Occupy Student Debt campaign. He's been active in the anti-sweatshop effort since the mid-1990s. He's written or been the editor of over 15 books, the most recent being Bird on Fire, Lessons from the World's Least Sustainable City, Oxford University Press, and Nice Work If You Can Get It, Life and Labor in Precarious Times by NYU Press. His organization's website is strikedebt.org. He will be joined by Charles Eisenstein. Charles is an independent scholar who writes about civilization and economics and transpersonal psychology and the evolution of human cultures. He is the past educator at Goddard College, Penn State University, and lived and worked as a translator in mainland China for many years. He has degrees in mathematics and philosophy from Yale and has been active with other visionaries to develop progressive models of business and charity based upon a deeper ethical standard. His two most important books, Sacred Economics, Money, Gift, and Society in the Age of Transition, which deals with the topic of the invention of money and the abandonment of the barter and gift economies, and his most recent book is The Ascent of Humanity, Civilization, and the Human Sense of Self. His websites are charleseisenstein.net and sacredeconomics.org. And they will be joined by Michael Kunzau. Michael is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to the creation of a New Deal in the 21st century. His work focuses on financial reform, unemployment, inequality, and progressive solutions for restoring the economy. Mike's blog, which is an important one, was named among the 25 financial blogs by Time Magazine, R-O-R-T-Y-B-O-M-B. And his writings have appeared in the Boston Review, the American Prospect, the Nation Slate, Dissent, and he's been a guest on PBS NewsHour. And that is also his website, which is rortybomb.wordpress.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be here.
Hi, Gary.
Hi. I'm going to begin with my own particular overview and then give each of you all the time necessary to give us the proper context of your answers. Unlike other programs, this is non-commercial, as well as we really look at this more like a classroom on the air. So please take whatever time you feel is necessary to elaborate in the issue. But first, the issue. The issue is that when I was growing up, and I'm not sure your ages, but as a baby boomer, most of the colleges that the people where I grew up went were public schools. The debt was very little, and generally there was a job waiting when we got out. And within a year or two, we paid off our debt. Also, my father was able to build a small home, about 1,200 square feet, on a 2% GI loan. That was paid off also. And so we didn't really have debt, but we also didn't have credit cards. It was the basic principle of my community, a small community in West Virginia, that it was better to be able to pay for things as you went, because you didn't want to buy a lot of things, and then if something happened to someone, the family would be holding that debt. Then by the mid-1970s, we saw that the enormous improvement in the standard of living for tens of millions of Americans, with up to 49% of the labor force represented by unions that had made major inroads in collective bargaining and work weeks and safety in the workplace, that began to be challenged at all levels. And for the past 35 years, the actual living standard for most people has, on the one hand, increased because of their indebtedness and the savings and the amount of take-home money, the amount of disposable income has decreased, except for bubbles. The bubble of the housing market is one example, the current bubble in Wall Street and the bond market. But most of the average Americans don't speculate in bubbles, not consciously. Most people didn't think that their home would be used as an ATM machine. And now we see the consequences of putting so much energy into offshoring jobs, the private-public sector partnerships, privatizing and making as much profit off everything that you can, that most people, the average person, about 245 million Americans, live with a high level of debt. Now to the issue specifically. One of the reasons that we invited this panel is because each shares a different perspective. Charles Eisenstein comes at the issues more as a philosopher and ethicist, and he will address many of the big picture issues. And he's also will address some of the older practices of Jubilee and debt forgiveness. And Mike is more, at least in my impressions, a postmodern New Deal Democrat. His main focus is on relieving home debts and critiquing banking practices and policies. And Andrew is involved in all kinds of debt relief issues, but comes at more of a labor perspective, a populist perspective. And right now, as student debt is a big item, for him, it's a big item for every family that has taken on the role of supporting or backing up those debts. According to the New York Fed, at the end of the fourth quarter of 2012, outstanding consumer debt was at $31 billion, and total consumer indebtedness was at $11.3 trillion. And when we consider this, we're looking at a debt that, in my opinion, can never be repaid, but will result in millions upon millions of Americans living in a servitude, a debt peonage system, to the banks and other institutions. We must also understand that there are now private jails in the United States. There are private constable services or marshal type services that can arrest people for bad debt or not paying their debt, put them in jail, and they can't get out till they pay the debt. But then when they're in jail, they're charged upwards of $135 a day while they're in jail. Imagine that. Return of the debt prison. 27 states now have debt prison. And for mortgage debt, the average is $150,000 per person, or $7.9 trillion is outstanding in mortgages owed. For student debt, 60% of students, or 12 million, are borrowing every year. Total is $1.7 trillion. There are 37 million student loans outstanding, and the majority of students under 30 years of age with little job prospects on the horizon. And for credit card debt, the average is $15,000 per person, or $848 billion outstanding. So here is the issue. Our current consumer debt is beyond comprehension for most Americans, and yet it has an extraordinary impact upon the well-being of society. Mike, we're going to begin with you, and then I'll ask the others to give their insights for this general opening question once you've completed your response. I'd like to begin with how national financial policies have contributed to the rise in debt and how banking and other financial institutions benefit from individual and family indebtedness, and therefore we find no incentive or efforts being made by Washington or Wall Street or loan institutions to lessen the debt burden on people. To the contrary, in one of the newest pieces of legislation a few years ago, they made it impossible for students to get out of their debt by filing bankruptcy, and the federal government doesn't allow you to student debts or even in many cases to prepay them. Your thoughts, please.
Sure. So the three big changes in the past
30 years regarding the kind of bucket of issues you brought up with debt and households can broadly be summarized by the deregulation of Wall Street, the risk shifting to individuals and into families from the state and from the federal government to local municipalities of basic social insurance and general dismantling and the non-expansion of this prosperity. And then the third is Federal Reserve policy to slowly focus more on price stability and the interest of creditors and people who hold financial assets, which is, you know, in large part debts, versus full employment and inflation. Now, all of those need to be understood within a larger context of political inequality and the kind of rise of a policy that's very focused on market-focused neoliberalism versus, you know, a more broader prosperity. But that's, you know, putting that aside because it's a whole several hours in and of itself. The three kind of large things you want to look at is one is the deregulation of finance. It's a project that starts under Jimmy Carter in the late 70s. And it continues up until the late 90s through Reagan, through George H.W. Bush, and through Bill Clinton. Some of the key things that you look at is essentially an abandonment of usury laws and of other kinds of state-level ways of managing household debt because of some Supreme Court decisions. Essentially, whatever state a bank was based out of would be the laws that would bind it across the nation. There are some other actions, particularly in the 2000s, to remove state-level anti-subprime lending laws through federal action. So essentially, you have a basic infrastructure that has evolved over, you know, a century, essentially, of how to, you know, legally try to rein in abusive and extensive debts was dismantled very quickly. Banks themselves began a large period of mergers, both across business lines, across states, leading to some very large firms that had business lines in them that essentially did not have to follow commercial banking law. So, you know, the normal kind of banking laws, rules that we've evolved, did not apply to subprime lenders who were often, you know, backed by the same banks, but just through complicated legal structures. Second, you saw a huge explosion in medical costs and therefore medical debt. You saw a huge, as Andrew Ross, I'm sure, will tell us, a huge explosion in the cost of colleges as states essentially abandoned the role of providing high-quality education for free. And so those kinds of costs. And then you saw essentially, you know, a tax on Social Security, wage declines, and other kinds of ways that showed that there really, you know, the median household, not to count for everyone below the median, suddenly found themselves much more strapped, and suddenly credit became a lifeline in a way of being able to mitigate the ups and downs, and mostly downs, of a lot of the business cycle. So debt became a lot more central to the lives of people at the moment at which it was being reinterpreted, re-legalized and rethought of and re-institutionalized as something that was much more pro-creditor. That culminates in the 2005 bankruptcy reform, though there were several bankruptcy reforms before that, that essentially makes it much more difficult to file for bankruptcy. Crucially, it drags out the procedure. It makes it so... it certainly makes it so that housing is not available for discharge, which plays a huge role in our current crisis and why the recovery has been so sluggish, and, you know, solidifies student loans as something that cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. Crucially, at the same time, during the same period, you see especially going back to the late 70s, you see the bankruptcy law, you know, this actual institutional thing that's the framework for our government, becomes much more useful for the top 1%, right? So you have people can take over companies and use bankruptcy to dislodge pension obligations, for instance. So the actual infrastructure for how debt survives in our country has a real policy shift that makes it much more repressive towards average working people and much more beneficial to those who hold financial assets and those who primarily are in charge of a lot of corporations or buy and sell them. So I think it's a very undertold story, but I think the policy mechanisms there explain a lot of why inequality has been so bad, why this recovery has been so brutal, and why debt is now functioning a lot more in people's lives than it has in the past.
Thank you, Michael. Charles, would you share your insights on this opening question?
Yeah, fascinating discussion already. I'd like to start by questioning the whole concept of debt forgiveness. because it kind of implies that the debtor has a moral obligation to repay and is in debt because of some kind of failing or some kind of sin, almost, and so it needs to be forgiven, you know. Picture you were painting of the 50s and the 60s, when, you know, people didn't buy, they paid for things as they went along and they didn't go into debt, it kind of recalls this, moral fiber that we seem to have lost. But as Mike was saying, the pressure to go into debt is systemic. And whether or not you're industrious and hardworking and go to college and do all the things you're supposed to do, there's a systemic necessity for more and more people to go into debt. So I'd like to use other words, like, I don't want to pick on your choice of words, but you know, it is a good way to illuminate this kind of assumption that we have that debt is due to some kind of personal failing. So I like to use terms like debt cancellation or debt nullification, things like that, that don't carry that moral judgment. And I mentioned something about the systemic pressure to go into debt. And all the things, the financial deregulation, the change in the bankruptcy laws, the change in the usury laws, wage declines, I mean, all these kinds of things, I think are, these are important, but they're also symptoms of a deeper issue or a deeper crisis, which is the crisis of the end of growth or the slowdown of growth, which has been a concept that's been mostly the province of, you know, the radical fringe environmentalists, you know, talking about the ecological limits of growth. But recently, more mainstream folks, Robert Gordon, for example, have been writing about the slowdown or the end of growth, which puts a lot of pressure on capital. You know, if you can't make a decent return on investment by making more stuff to serve growing demand, then the only way you can get a return on capital is basically to take it from people who have it. And so you get all of these, equity bubbles, housing bubbles, and all these other ways of privatization, of essentially hollowing out the middle class and transferring wealth to the wealthy. And it's driven, even like the financial deregulation is driven by this kind of desperation on the part of capital to generate returns. And so this is a crisis that won't go away. And I'll just say one more thing, you know, debt is a social agreement. When we talk about, you know, 13 or 11.3 trillion dollars in consumer debt or private debt, I can't remember which it is. Anyway, some enormous number, or whatever, $15 trillion of national debt, all these different numbers. What are these really? These are simply bits in computers, zeros and ones, that have power only because of our social agreement around them. And that agreement can change. That debt could be wiped away. Even, you know, in theory, Congress could print money. It has the right in the Constitution to do that. And we print fiat currency like Abraham Lincoln did in the Civil War, and pay off all the debt. And sooner or later, as you said, debts that can't be paid won't be. Sooner or later, that's going to happen. And I think it's a good time right now to start talking about debt cancellation and start talking about what is the most equitable way to transition into a financial system that doesn't require endless and growing debt.
Okay, I appreciate those insights, Charles. Andrew, your thoughts, please.
Very interesting conversation so far. I certainly like the sound of debt cancellation. We call it debt refusal also, which puts the the emphasis on people taking responsibility for relieving themselves of debt by any means necessary, which probably will involve, you know, acts of civil disobedience, because that's what debt refusal is under the current legal conditions. I want to emphasize the components of the crisis situation that we're in currently. There's widespread recognition that current household debt burdens are entirely unsustainable. They're largely, I agree with Mike, they're largely a result of policy shifts in the last 30 years or so that have favored the creditor class. And when that happens, historically, in democracies at least, when elected representatives cannot protect the population from harms that are visited upon them by the creditor class, these democracies fail fairly rapidly and become oligarchies, and even worse, debt slavery and debt peonage results. That's the historical record, at least. And what we're seeing right now in many countries, especially in the Eurozone, the south of the Eurozone, are failed democracies where the interests of creditors are being prioritized over the needs of the general population. And whenever those democratic electorates get a chance to vote, if they vote the wrong way, they're simply ignored. They're asked to vote again, which has happened a few times, especially in Ireland, giving rise to a rich new vein in Irish humor. But we also forget in this country that the first big TARP bailout was rejected by Congress. And then it was sent back about a week later, barely amended, so that the proper vote could take place. So these are symptoms of failed democracies in a way, which really deepen the sense of crisis that we're talking about. The moralism that Charles mentioned is very, very important. It's the glue that holds the finance sector together. It's the shame and the guilt that's attached to being in debt, and it surrounds this. This concept that it's a personal test of your moral or your ethical responsibility as a human being to always pay back your debts. That's the glue that holds the finance sector together. It's been sorely tested in the last few years because we've seen the double standard exposed time and time again when Wall Street banks are not expected to pay back their debts or they're bailed out. And that continues to this day when governments step in and say, we need to save the banks. It's only the little people who are supposed to pay back their debts. So there's been an erosion over the last few years of popular belief in this cement, this glue that holds the finance sector together. We're not quite at the point where people are willing to break entirely with that morality. But we may still be just at the beginning of a fledgling debtors movement, which will bring that about through acts of civil disobedience. The last thing I would just mention, and again, it's really in building on what Charles mentioned about degrowth. I think that's an absolutely crucial point. We're at the point where any successor economy that we might look forward to cannot rely on GDP growth as its primary engine. The cost and the impact of carbon emissions and the toll on environmental depletion is already far in excess of planetary limits. And at this point, I don't think there's no returning to the status quo ante when national growth machines in that post-war period were fueled by very easy borrowing, and when the expectation of GDP growth was there to reassure lenders of steady returns. That's a debt growth system that has run aground, and it won't be restored, I think, very easily. If it is restored, then the outcome will be ecologically calamitous.
I'm going to ask each of you a challenging question, challenging to the myths that we live by. And if you could give us just a slightly abbreviated answer on this. Andrew, I'm going to start with you. Here are what I see contradictions, and I'd like you to give us your input. One contradiction is that in the last 30 years, we have outsourced over 7 million minimal jobs. We have closed down 58,000 factories in the last 12 years. And these are probably more, but these are statistics that are official statistics. And also, we have not had any substantive increase in the cost of living adjustments or in people's wages, real wages, over the last 35 years. As a result, it's forced a lot of people just to do the basics, to buy food, to pay car payments, to pay their mortgage or rent, to use credit card. On the other hand, knowing that people didn't have an actual living wage, most people didn't, where they could buy these things without going into debt, they made it so easy for people to get into debt, including liar loans and low interest loans. And then when people started to find problems, instead of helping them on any ethical level, they penalized them. Suddenly your interest, which was 18% on a standard credit card, would go to 60%. If it's a debit card, it could go to 200% if you delayed your payment or could not make the full payment. So the more in debt someone became, the greater the profit came to the cardholders. Now, that led to this idea. How is it that the banks are getting their money, $21 trillion, do the addition, you mentioned the first bailout, but now there were three subsequent bailouts, and two of them were secret, and only by Bernie Sanders of the Independent from Vermont and Ron Paul wanting to audit the Fed, we found that there were 22,000 transactions, principally to 20 banks, for over $16 trillion. But we were never told what the collateral was. Then we find out it was junk. Anything that they had done bad, any bad mistakes, were washed through the Federal Reserve. They got their money at interest. Zero. It was actually 0.25%. And then they loan that money to cardholders or others who are giving them 20%. They paid zero. Well, I don't care how you handle that. That's a 2,000% profit. So you would think that at some point, rather than seeing people lose their homes, bring down the cost of a mortgage, let them pay rent, let them pay a percentage of their total income, so you wouldn't have a whole lot of abandoned homes and massive loss of property value, ghettoization of whole areas. The bank said, no, we're not going to forgive your debt. We're not going to forgive the interest on your debt. We're not going to lower the interest on your debt. And if you don't pay us, we're going to ruin your credit. So my question to you then, these are contradictions I see. If the banking systems were held to the same standards that you and I are, and if we're told that we want no socialism for the working person, we want to cut back their social safety net, okay, fine, then start with yourself. All these major banks would be bankrupt, every single one. Not one would be left standing. I've done the analysis. Not one stupid bank would be left standing of the top 20 in the United States. But they're still holding over $230 trillion in derivative positions, and they have unlimited amounts of money they can borrow, and yet they won't give us a break. Why is it that we have not rebelled against this? Why is it Congress continues to support them and not us? Why is it this president continues to support the banks, the lending institutions, Wall Street, but not the average person? Those are my concerns.
Well, I think that's a fair analysis. I mean, the most immediate answer is that they have, accumulated an immense amount of power, and they have produced a situation where legislators, even if they had the political will to act, are incapable of doing so, which is why, at least in our sector of the debtors movement, we don't spend a lot of time in petitioning lawmakers for reforms, because we think they're just not in a position to deliver reforms. The record of the last 4 years, I think, is fairly clear on that. Whatever reforms have been proposed or implemented have been cosmetic. You mentioned contradictions, Gary, though, which is important, I think, because if you look at how capitalist elites accumulate wealth, it's either through interest, rate, a rent or profit, the three different sectors. And they're sometimes in competition with each other. In fact, they're often in competition with each other. They don't work seamlessly in sync. And sometimes we reach a point where, for example, right now, the level of indebtedness is so large, the debt burden is so large, that it's impairing the ability of households to contribute to other sectors. National economic managers are very hard put right now to figure out how they're going to sustain the so-called American dream. Because the debt burden in households or in student debtors in particular who are entering this trajectory of the American dream are simply unable to imagine how they could afford a house and children and high-ticket consumer goods. So that's a real headache for national economic managers. And the main reason is because the creditor class has been taking far too big a cut in terms of the interest. I can give you other examples of how these contradictions pop up, but this is probably the biggest one right now. And normally we look to the state to harmonize all of these interests, at least capitalist elites do. And right now the state is in a complete pickle. I think, you know, national economic managers simply don't know how to resolve this situation, how to resolve these contradictions, to use that classical turn of phrase.
Okay, I appreciate that insight, Andrew. Charles, we have seen with the Occupy movement, mainly, but not exclusively, younger people, many of them college, in college or out of college, who have been protesting this inequality. Why haven't we seen a national strike by students and teachers, at the very least, to eliminate all interest debt? Because the banks that are giving them these interest are getting the money for zero. The government makes 30 cents a dollar for every student loan they get. So they're in the business of making a profit and exploit it. Yet the government won't allow you the concessions of reducing off a loan. I'll call on behalf of someone I know who said, can you help get this loan down? It was $7,000 to one school. And they said, no, it's a government loan. We don't discount anything. All right. So why isn't it that the students aren't organizing, because they're clearly major victims here? And yet I don't see that massive movement yet. What is it going to take, and why aren't they doing it yet?
I don't know why they're not doing it yet. I think partly because of learned political apathy, this has deep roots, you know, learned through our whole educational system, where we're trained to receive knowledge from authority and put through a system in which we have no say in what the curriculum is. You know, we're walking through the path that's laid out for us. And there are many other trends toward political apathy. I think it's going to probably take more desperation before and more consciousness around how the system works before we see a movement like that. But I do think that debt could very well be what triggers an expression of people power in the United States. Because it's universal, it crosses religious lines, it crosses ethnic lines, age. I mean, everybody is more and more subject to debt. And the civil disobedience, as Andrew was calling it, is so simple. And I can imagine a movement where people are burning their account statements just as they burned their draft cards during the Vietnam War.
Okay, let me do a follow-up with that. I've just returned doing 4 years of filming a major documentary called Poverty Inc. I've had a chance to speak with people at all walks of life about how they're dealing with their new dilemma. And from every category, from the professional class, where you have adjunct professors working in car washes, and you have former engineers bagging groceries at a public supermarket, no one wants to fight back. They're angry, but more often than not, they've resigned themselves that their predicament's not going to change. A lot of them will start to listen to either the left or right corporate media because it's blaming all the problems in the world on the other. And This is a volleyball game back and forth. And I say, but what are you personally doing for the people to help your situation? and more I find that there is apathy. Now, the second part of it. When you're in Greece now, and you're in Athens, at one time one of the most beautiful cities in the world, today it's a ghetto. There are many streets you just don't go down. Crime is rampant. People are dumpster diving who were school teachers. You have pensioners who are now can't afford to even stay in their home, let alone buy their food and medicines. So the austerity program has crippled them. That is also true in other countries. Now today it's Slovakia, and also in Spain, and in Portugal. But they all have something in common. They're angry with their government, but their government continues to support the European Union's model and saying you've got to give up all these entitlements, you can no longer have all this free medical care, no longer free education, no longer do you get your water for free. We're going to privatize your water, privatize your roads, privatize parking, privatize everything. And then I ask a basic question. Now, mind you, I've asked this to so many people. Do you know where the money goes when they say that you have to be austere and you have to sacrifice so that something gets paid? Well, it's the debt. And then I ask them to explain it to me. More often than not, the vast majority of people believe that that debt is going for payment of immediate debts inside their government, inside their communities. And I say, what if I told you that all of that debt goes to the people who help get you in this mess, to bondholders and to banks and financially savvy people? And they look at you and their jaw drops. I said, yeah, the people that help put you in this predicament are getting the money out, and you are having to pay for it by your sacrifices. And they said, well, that's not fair. And suddenly you start to see, gee whiz, maybe they didn't understand the full problem. And that's also true in Ireland. So take a look at the social inequality in Europe, the structural, in effect, what amounts to a structural adjustment, but called an austerity program all over Europe. And then look at the United States and what we're asking here. Do you see anything happening in Europe happening here? Do you see that we have the ability to stop being distracted and focus upon the real problem makers?
Well, I think in Europe there is a lot more awareness than there is here about where the money's actually going. People are starting to see through the whole game. Here we're still, you know, this kind of answers the question you asked Andrew too. You know, why have the banks been getting away with it all? You know, why is the government not doing anything? There's kind of a narrative capture, you might say, where people take for granted certain assumptions that guarantee that no meaningful changes can happen. And it takes something has to happen to shake that narrative that tells you that there really is no alternative. And one of those things is, you know, just worsening misery. But we just haven't got there yet, quite here.
So we're not in enough pain.
Yeah, you know, it's still possible to pretend that it's working.
Okay.
Here.
All right, well, good. Then Mike, yeah. If we pretend it's working, and let's go to something that Charles had mentioned and Andrew as well, that we cannot sustain anything in the future the way we have in the past. We would have to have 1.5 to 2 planets for the way that we burn through our natural resources. We also are now struck with this paradox. The vast majority of people who are supporting the building of homes, the building of gated communities or the suburban sprawl, the all of the service industries, those people are the ones who've been hardest hit now. Most of those jobs are not coming back. Even in yesterday's New York Times front page headline talked about how the founder of Facebook has joined with other Silicon people to get legislation passed that makes it easier to get in a special type of visa employee, highly skilled, that we can see working for 1/2 to 1/3 the salary of a highly skilled American with none of the benefits. And so that's the big push. But what the New York Times did not report on is that this has actually been going on for the last 10 years. and that they're law firms. I actually have recordings of these law firms' recruiting sessions where the entire theater is filled with major corporations looking to say, okay, I got an employee who's worked for me for 20 years, and we're paying him $180,000 a year plus benefits plus all this accrued sick time and vacation time. And the lawyers say, not a problem. We can bring in someone who has excellent skills, who will work with none of that, none of the bonuses, none of that, plus work for half the profit. So you're going to make at the end of the year all this extra profit. And that's what's been going on. No one's talked about that. So now when we look at our economy and we look at the fact that the average American cannot afford a home, and by the way, don't be deceived for a second that the economy is doing great. The economy is not doing great because Wall Street's making, which represents 17% of our viable gross domestic product, is doing so through the financial services of making profits off debt and not off building factories or employing people. As a result, more Americans don't have money to buy, don't have money to pay taxes. And without those taxes, the services provided at the state, local, and national level are drying up. So where is this new dystopian environment supposed to occur when we have just dumped two-thirds of the American population off the side of the financial cliff?
I think it's useful to contrast what's going on here with Europe. Europe is in a much graver situation, in part because they are actually destroying the monetary base of places like Greece and places like the Mediterranean region. So the people who control the money there are explicit in trying to essentially blackmail economies into forcing these kind of neoliberal structural changes. They're entirely anti-democratic. And it's really devastating there. Here, there's a lot of criticisms to be made, but the Federal Reserve is, Ben Bernanke is calling for more stimulus. He said that, we need investments. We need essentially the Congress needs to be doing more, and I think he is making a good faith effort to avoid the problems of deflation. As bad as the debt problems would be right now, if the Fed tightened money, you would have these kind of spiral effects even more aggressively than we've seen in really hard-hit areas. Why aren't people reacting more sharply? One is that debt is hard to organize people on. It's not something that people are proud of in, really any way, that they've had medical bills when they didn't have medical insurance, that they invested in a home that is now not worth as much as they thought it would be. It's this identity that was brought up earlier that they somehow failed. One area you can kind of push back a little bit on that is, with students, where I think people have a very positive identity as students. They think of education as part of a right, something that they've worked hard for and something that they shouldn't have to essentially indenture themselves to take part of. How will the future economy evolve? Right now I actually don't think the economy is particularly shifting in the ways that was kind of hinted at. I think wherever you look across occupations or industries, there's a lot of unemployment, there's a lot of slackness that could be tightened up. The debt problem, in part because a lot of it's very concentrated into some areas that had a lot of mortgage problems. It's also, the national economy is one body. So homeowners in Southern California or Arizona or Nevada that were particularly hit has a drag effect on places that had, much shallower, housing bubbles and crashes. What I worry about right now is how young people are going to adapt. We're seeing very low rates of labor market participation. We're seeing high student debts. We're seeing young people who are not forming households. They're living at home unemployed. I'm not saying that everyone should get a mortgage or a car or, a house. There's a lot of ways to lead your life, but we're curiously seeing young people just not being active members in the labor market or in the more public sphere. And, that is really problematic for the economy to work, because we eventually need young people to kind of become, consumers, take over jobs. And the fact that they aren't, and what I think the flip side of a lot of this is that a lot of older people are very worried about their retirements, which means they're very much saving at a rapid pace, which is great for them, but bad for everyone to save at the same time, and especially in the government to go into austerity. So those things all together have me worried about that. I mean, this is a very specific diagnosis. And I don't think like 2007 was like a miraculous time, but I don't think we should approach a situation like the economy was clearly collapsing. Because I do think there are things we can do to heal it that don't involve really radical transformations.
I would agree with that. Thanks for this comment. Charles, as an ethicist, do you have the same concerns I do about the return of going to jail because you can't pay a ticket, a traffic ticket, or pay some debt? Because we now have debtors' prisons. This is a reality. It's not myth. It's not futuristic. It's now. And many institutions that historically would have, you know, to pestered you or possibly sued you in civil court are now seeking jail time, knowing that someone, somewhere, a relative is going to have to bail you out. So not only do you owe the debt, but you frequently owe in one day more than your debt was worth. And then we have the extreme where a SWAT team breaks down the door with guns pointed at a family to arrest a student who was 6 months late on student loans in California. The student wasn't there, but shook up the whole family. It was a woman, including her husband and her kids. So we have militarized this to a point where you don't know what kind of reactions you're going to get, but this is something we historically would not have expected. A SWAT team showing up to arrest you because you didn't pay a student loan. True story, in California. So that's where we're at today. Your thoughts on the ethics of debtors' prisons and why Congress is allowing it to happen and state legislators are allowing it to happen as well.
Well, I don't think it takes a lot of analysis to condemn debtors' prisons. If moral suasion doesn't work, then maybe police force will work. But I think that part of this is just to like I can't remember who was saying it, but that the whole system hangs on the perception of the legitimacy of debt, and when people and that has to be maintained at all costs. In fact, the consequences of default are not necessarily as bad as people think if you are educated. And I think it's Strike Debt, perhaps. I can't remember where I saw it, but it's a debt resistor's handbook that you can download online. And there are lots of ways, there's lots of ways to minimize to live a pretty good life, without playing along with the system. And I think that this kind of resistance, whether it's conscious or passive, is only going to grow. And there are other ways to resist, too. Even if you don't owe debt, you can withdraw in certain ways from the economy. You can join the sharing economy. And anytime you do that, like people are setting up tool libraries, and time banks and meeting each other's needs, sharing things online, open source software, things like that. And every time someone does that, it reduces demand and slows economic growth, which is a problem. If your rescue plan depends on increasing demand and consumption, and it's important to note that our measures of standard of living, which are framed in terms of GDP, only measure the things that can be measured. And they don't measure the loss of community, the loss of connection, the loss of skills, the loss of all the things that really make life rich. So I think that this might be my closing note. All of these things are the anti-debt movement is part of a much larger shift. We have to ask. Well, maybe I'll leave it at that for now.
Okay, I appreciate that. Yeah. Andrew, your closing solutions to our audience, please.
Well, let me just confirm what Charles has said. Strike Debt does have a debt resistors operations manual. It's available. It can be downloaded for free from our website. And we're doing an expanded edition, which includes a lot of comments that have been sent in by users and readers. And it's a handbook that's designed to help people relieve themselves of their debt burdens and evict the power of creditors from their lives. But it does also speak, I think, to something that Charles said, this fantasy of going off the grid, which a lot of younger people are feeling is a very attractive romance right now. It includes default. It could include collective refusal of debt, but it certainly does include default. And the reality is the levels of default are rising like floodwaters. If you look at student debt, for example, in our Occupy Student Debt campaign, we floated a pledge at the beginning of the campaign asking for people to refuse to pay their debts after a million others had signed up. Now, for one reason or another, I can't go into any great detail. The numbers didn't come anywhere near a million. But the reality is that over the course of the next year, 1 million student defaulters, 1 million student debtors did default, but they defaulted individually and suffered the consequences psychologically and economically. If they defaulted together, if they'd refused together, collectively, that would have had a considerable political impact. So it's really, the challenge is really to get from this this sort of isolated and individualized condition of people feeling that they're simply not able to pay, they go into default, to get from there towards the position where people are acting in concert, and that requires a lot of organization. And as Mike suggested earlier, it's true, organizing around debt is not an easy thing to do. It's not like organizing around wages, which have a collective character, and it's easy for people to see their common interests and pursue it. Debts are highly individualized. That's one of the problems. And it's in the interests of the financial industry to make sure that debtors in the aggregate do not see that they have a common interest, and to maintain this individual, individualized sense of morality, which is one of the biggest obstacles to challenging. But I'm allergic to despair. I think we'll get there. I think we're just in the early days or the early months or years of a fully fledged debtors movement.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew. Charles, your final closing thoughts, please.
The power of a debtors movement doesn't depend on even getting out in the streets and doing something, you know, and in a society that's been reduced to what is called clicktivism and the manipulation of symbols on screens, debt resistance is maybe the only thing that we have left as far as a potent way to express real democracy. So I'm very grateful for you, Gary, that you brought this topic onto the air, because as Andrew and Michael both said, it's hard to gather a mass consciousness around debt, but we're working on it.
Yes, we are. A few final thoughts for myself here. I certainly subscribe to the idea of debt cancellation, debt nullification, debt relief, and for those who choose the concept of forgiveness, though today we're not a forgiving culture. And I'm interested in why we have become so unforgiving. And even when I'm traveling and I talk with a family who, the morning I'm filming, I see a neighbor there with their van, and I see the marshals there to evict them. And so I ask the people, you're watching this behind closed doors. Did you go out to see what you might be able to do? Words of comfort, anything you might be able to do to give some support to that person across the street? Did you know it was coming? Have you met with anyone else in your block? Have you organized to go house to house to say, isn't there something we could do together to strengthen our resolve rather than facing this dilemma one at a time? And the people would just look down as if, no, as if, well, it's, and one person said, it's inevitable. I said, it's not inevitable. I said, here's the irony. The bank that is going to foreclose to get those marshals to come and evict you without any concern of where you're going has already evicted 44 million Americans. That's how many have gone thus far. 6 million more homes are underwater. They're likely to also lose their homes. That would bring us to over 58 million Americans without homes, without anyone caring what happened to them. That's a powerful political force if they stood together. You look in your wallet, you have the credit card of the very bank that's likely, after using their power and convincing Congress through lobbying to vote on their rules, they can charge you usurious rates. When you can't pay, they're going to throw you out. So why would you use their credit card? Why not join food co-ops and farmers markets? Why not join barter and exchange groups? Why not meet with people who have learned how to get off grids in many levels and how to support putting your money into a credit union or starting what Professor Ellen Brown suggests is a state bank? And they look at you as if they don't know what you're saying, but clearly they do. I think we need a national resolve to make this an issue now. And I think the only thing that will change our position and galvanize us, at least those willing to be galvanized, is for some national disaster to occur that supersedes political will and debt power at the banks. When you have a Hurricane Sandy, or you have an earthquake, you have something really that hits everyone, suddenly we go, what? I better get awake. Then maybe we'll pay attention to how we can survive in the future by getting where we can and how we choose off the grid. Gentlemen, thank you all for joining us. I appreciate your input.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on.
Okay, I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you all for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.